books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and today I'm chatting to partners Val McDermott and Joe Sharp about the novel they penned together, This Door of the Seas. And as this show debuts on Book Club Day UK, we'll have a chat about RNIB's Talk and Support Book Clubs. Plus, we'll find some new books in the RNIB library. There are moments in history that change the course of a nation, yet somehow remain surprisingly little known. For Scotland, one of those moments was the Darien Venture, an ambitious attempt in the late 17th century to establish a Scottish trading colony on the Isthmus of Panama. What began as a dream of prosperity ended in disaster, bankruptcy, and ultimately helped pave the way towards political union with England. In the new book, This Door of the Seas, couple novelist Val McDermott and geographer Joe Sharp bring the story to life in a very different way. Told through a series of letters home from expedition scientist James Wallace, it's a story of ambition, hope, rivalry, hardship, and the devastating consequences when an extraordinary dream begins to unravel. I went to the Canongate Audio Studio in Edinburgh to watch Val and Joe record the introduction to the book, and I spoke to them about rediscovering this remarkable chapter of Scottish history, why the Darien story still resonates today, and the challenge of turning historical events into a compelling and very human story. The body of the text of The Door of the Seas is narrated by Andrew Rothney. But first, let's hear Joe Sharp's very first time narrating a book, narrating the intro to The Door of the Seas.
Syracuse, New York, April 20th, 2026. To Archive Acquisition, National Library of Scotland, Edinburgh. I enclose a photocopy of a collection of papers that I would like to donate to the National Library of Scotland. I came across the papers when I was clearing out my father's home after his death at the end of last year. The papers are loosely bound in a leather case, and although I have struggled to decipher some of the handwriting, I realised that they relate to the events that first brought my family to America nearly three centuries ago. I remember my father telling me stories about this when I was a child, but I had forgotten his tales until I came by these papers. To be honest, I was not sure I had ever really believed the tales were true until I held the papers in my own hands. They comprised the draft letters and notes from, if my father's calculations were correct, my 11 times great-grandfather, Dr. James Wallace, a scientist who was one of the more than 2,000 brave souls who set sail from Scotland in 1698 and 1699 for the jungle of Darien in Panama. Although astonishingly, to most of the colonists, including James, it was an unknown destination, where they were to establish a trading colony to improve the riches for the nation.
I'm Val McDermott. I'm a writer and broadcaster.
I'm Joe Sharp. I'm a professor of geography.
This is the story of Scotland's attempt to form a colony in the end of the 17th century. The country was going through dire straits at the time. It had three famines, lost 15% of its working population, and it needed some source of income. And so a man called William Paterson came up with the brilliant idea of founding a trading colony in Panama, in the jungles of Darien.
James was a protege of Sir Robert Sibbald, geographer royal, founder of the Edinburgh Botanic Gardens and physician to the King. He sailed on the first of two expeditions. I expect you will recognise the name Darien, though not perhaps too much of the story that another jungle has grown up around. I remember that when he told us the tale, my father would always say that the real story, James's story, had been lost, its truths outgrown by myth and legend. he dismissed the histories of Darien that mocked the Scots for their ineptitude or their inability to go it alone, insisting that James's was the true account. The first part of the papers appears to contain drafts of letters to James's wife Eliza, who was to join him in Darien a year later as part of the second expedition, and to Sir Robert to report back on the flora and fauna he discovered in this new world. Of course, communication was clearly unreliable and so slow in those days, and I suspect that James wanted to keep copies of his letters so that he had a record of his experiences, but also so that he could rewrite his correspondence should he discover they had not arrived. The letters to Eliza appear to be complete, while the bulk of those that I assume were to go to Sir Robert are in the form of notes and observations. And there's also part of a list of questions in a different hand, which appear to be the requests from Sir Robert himself. The length and detail of this list suggests my ancestor must have been a very patient man.
Was he a real person?
William Paterson was very much a real person. He was one of the founders of the Bank of England, and he subsequently went on to found the Bank of Scotland. So he was very real.
And one of the characters is also a predecessor of yours.
So our main character is a young scientist who was signed up to go by the first Geographer Royal for Scotland, and I'm the sixth Geographer Royal for Scotland. And so we wrote the book as a series of letters from our character, Dr. James Wallace, to the first Geographer Royal, Robert Sibbald, and also to his wife, Eliza, who was going to join him in a later expedition.
That was the mechanism. The vision came from one man, Mr. William Paterson. Mr. Paterson had already proved himself a noble leader in his founding of the Bank of England. At first, Mr. Paterson presented his proposal to both English and Scottish parliaments, but when the English refused to support him, he was unabashed, and his energies then turned to improving the lives of the people of his own country. So strong was his conviction that he had found the perfect location for such a colony that he threw his full weight behind a plan that would make it possible for us Scots to act independently. The strength of support for Mr. Paterson's plans threatened the English, and there were fears they would work against the Scots' success. Thus, further preparations were made under complete secrecy. The brave colonists who signed up to join the expedition did so without any knowledge of where they were bound. This did not dampen the enthusiasm of the Scots for this enterprise. Support for the company poured in from across the country, and Mr. Paterson raised promise of £400,000, a vast figure, perhaps as much as half the currency available in the country. Five ships were bought, the flagship St. Andrew and the Caledonia, Unicorn, Dolphin and Endeavour. Councillors and captains, sailors and soldiers were recruited. Trade goods and supplies were amassed. Our leaders and military men were offered a salary for their efforts in establishing Scotland's colony. The colonists themselves were promised nothing more than a piece of land once they'd helped build and establish the colony. Yet more people than could be accommodated on board clamoured for a place.
And it's very much a one-way letter writing. Yeah, I know that the letters are fictional, but would Eliza have been able to reply?
She could have sent letters, but whether they got there is another question. It took a long time to get from Scotland to Panama in those days, and a long time to get responses back. So we don't know if there were any responses from the Scots, their families at home, but we thought it would be too complicated to include that, to be honest.
The Scots colonists had expected their letters to get back, and they were expecting to hear from Scotland. And one of the moments of tension, I think, in the book is that expectation of hearing from home and not hearing, for a variety of reasons that will be disclosed in the book. So there was that expectation that although letters would take a long time, that there would be an exchange of information and other things backwards and forwards across the Atlantic.
Yeah, we are on the scene one side of the conversation, but we do see Paterson's letters getting... Well, there's a tone shift.
There's a tone shift because things did not work out as they were supposed to do. And Paterson went home to Scotland on the Caledonia. And so he was safely back in the UK while the colonists were trying to stay alive and build a colony in the most adverse of circumstances. So they perhaps were not as friendly towards William Paterson towards the end as they had been at the beginning.
My beloved Eliza, our maiden voyage from Leith, though brief, has done nothing to dampen our high spirits. In truth, we felt ourselves buoyed across the Firth by the cheers of the populace lining the quayside to bid us farewell. None of us had ever seen such crowds nor heard such gusto before. I know you were among them, but I had no hope of seeing you among the mob of well-wishers, which saddened me in great measure. But more than that, it gladdened my heart to see such support for our endeavour. We are this evening in Kirkcaldy, a short sail across the Forth. We are here to receive our final papers before setting off on this monumental journey halfway across the world to establish the new foundation of our country's wealth. It is a frustration that we are now obliged to wait for our official instructions from the directors of the Company of Scotland. We are all in a ferment of excitement and anxiety, but must be patient for a little longer.
And much of this is at heart why this is such an important story for Scotland, because without this incident, it's very unlikely we would have had union with England, certainly not at the time and not in the way that it happened. And we have our protagonist as someone who was very proud of his Scottish identity and was determined to use this as an opportunity to improve his own situation. But he also saw this as a way of improving Scotland's situation. It was a way of countering that poverty that Val mentioned at the beginning. And the fact that this ended up with union with England and William Paterson ended up being a staunch supporter of that was of great personal pain to our character James Wallace and many of the others who went on the expedition. And union was not popular in Scotland in 1707, when the money for the equivalents, the money that the English were sending to Scotland as a payment for union, essentially, was so unpopular that those bearing it to Scotland were stoned as they came across the border and into Scottish towns. So the lairds were quite keen to get this money. The well-to-do were very happy to receive this, but the vast majority of the Scottish population were not interested. And in fact, there was a proposal for a national plebiscite, a referendum, if you like, as to whether there should be a union. And it would have been the first referendum, we think anywhere, that would have included women as well as men in the vote.
Not all of us are sufficiently patient, however. As we passed the Bass Rock on our way to Fife, a Mr. Dalrymple and his friend jumped overboard and swam for shore. Our captain assures me that these hotheads will be hunted down and prosecuted, for they have been paid 2 weeks' wages in advance. I'm proud and relieved to say that their example was scoffed at by everyone else on board.
You've edited a book together before, but this is the first book you've written before. How was it, and are you still friends?
We're still very close, yes. I had no idea how it was going to go. My mother always used to say, you don't play well with others, do you? And there's certain some truth in that. But I suppose Jo's skill in research, because being an academic, she understands how to go about researching something. And to begin with, the first period of working on the book, she had her own way to get on with the research, because I was recovering from major heart surgery and I couldn't do very much except lie there and say, that's lovely, darling. But as we came towards the actual writing of the book, it was very collaborative. We there was no hard division of labour, one writing one bit and one writing another, but we'd just pick it up and write it as we saw fit.
Yes, we'd originally thought, I think, that I would write the letters to Sir Robert, because they would be slightly more scientific, and Val would write the letters to Eliza. But the way it ended up was, it was whoever was ready to do some writing did the writing. I'd like to think you can't see the joins, but we moved backwards and forwards quite a lot in terms of who took the lead on particular bits. But I think what made it easier was that we talked about it so much before we started. So we really had a very clear idea of what we were going to do before we sat down. And so, you know, we'd got it fairly clear in our minds. And then every now and then one of us, oh, I've had a great idea. Or we could include this, or we could go in this direction. And
another one would go, I don't think so.
So we're recording this in the Canongate Studios in Edinburgh. Now that an audio version of it is going to be made, is that important that it's accessible to someone, for whatever reason, can't access print.
Absolutely. I mean, audio is one of the regions of communication that has expanded hugely in recent years, and it's made it possible for people who, for all sorts of reasons, can't access print. They may have visual difficulties, they may have difficulties reading, they may be dyslexic, whatever. Books are now accessible to them in a way they never were before, and that's great.
Here, on the fine ship Unicorn, under the command of Captain Pinkerton, my lodgings are Spartan enough, though in comparison to the cramped and likely insanitary conditions of those colonists we hope will build our future, I have little to complain of. I am obliged to share my cabin, which is no bigger than a kitchen press, with a ship's surgeon, a Mr. Fraser, who seems to have little to say for himself. I am grateful to have commandeered the upper berth, which allows me to read and to write in some comfort. I spent much of today assisting the expedition accountant, Mr. Alexander Hamilton, with his inventory of the goods we are transporting for trade. We have much wool cloth, linen, fine cotton and silks, copperware, combs, mirrors, lanterns, periwigs and Bibles. Then we checked the objects we would need to establish our new settlement. Axes, saws, hammers, nails, spades and pickaxes. Everyday essential items such as pots and kettles, candles, needles and thread, and, of course, those items required to keep our ship afloat, tar and pitch, spare ropes and sails. I had hoped this inventory might have given me some insight into our destination, but alas, I am no closer to knowing it.
This Door of the Seas is part of the Darkland Tales series. Written by Joe Sharp and Val McDermid, it's narrated by Joe Sharp and Val McDermid and Andrew Rothney. With thanks to Joe and Val and Al at the Canongate Studios, This Door of the Seas is available in all formats commercially, and there are over 50 Val McDermid books in the RNIB library.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
Finishing a book sometimes is more than simply getting to the end of a story. It's a chance to escape, to discover something new, and perhaps most importantly, to share that experience with other people. For readers with low or no sight, finding opportunities to talk about books with others can sometimes be a little more difficult. That's where RNIB's Talk and Support book clubs come in, bringing readers together to discuss what they've been reading and to enjoy that sense of community. Let's hear from Talk and Support book club member Julie Collins.
I'm Julie and I've been at the book club since the beginning. I love joining in with it. We do it every month and I've chose books a few times and I absolutely love books, to be honest. I always have done. I'm not totally blind at the moment, but I've started losing my sight. What it was, last June, I'd gone to the opticians for a normal eye test, and they were taking extra long time. Normally, I have to wear glasses for reading. I have done since I was about 11, so I just thought that I knew my eyes were deteriorating because obviously I was getting older. I was 58 then and I just thought it was a normal thing, you know. And I'd had my eyes done at another optician's when we lived in Milton Keynes and we'd moved to Northampton. So we'd gone to a different optician and they were very concerned. And he got somebody else to come in and they said to me that for my age, I had a cataract in both eyes that were fully developed for my age and they shouldn't be like that, but they told me that I needed to go to the eye clinic and they thought that there was something else wrong. And I wondered at the time if it was to do with what my mum had, because my mum has Fuchs dystrophy, which is hereditary, which is also called cornea disease. Because I say cornea disease because people think I'm swearing and I'm not. Unfortunately, not many people in this country know what it is. So it's quite hard. And it was good that he noticed it. He's been brilliant. And I will only see him now. I won't see any others at the optician. I will only see him because he knows what's going on.
How long have you been listening to RNIB Talking Books?
I've been listening to Talking Books for about a year, because I asked for help when I found out that I had this eye condition, because my eyes are getting worse. I'm in a catch-22, so I'm slowly losing my sight. And I was quite distraught, and I said that I couldn't read anymore. And somebody, a young woman, came and helped me. And they said about talking books, and I said I really wanted to listen. So she put an app on, and that's it. I haven't stopped since.
Now, do you think the club has made you read books that you maybe wouldn't have read?
Yes, it's been quite interesting, actually. Most of the books have been brilliant. I mean, obviously, you always get a dodgy one, don't you? But there's been books like, for example, like Richard Attenborough. I love Richard Attenborough, and I have watched him on the telly before, but I would never thought about listening to one of his books. And that was really good. And then I chose a one about a hare. I would have never done that. To be quite honest, I would have never listened to that normally, but I like psychological ones, but sometimes it gets a bit too much. So it's nice to listen to something different. So yeah, because we've all got different interests, it's quite good because we all have a go at a different book. We've all said this as well. Like you're trying something that you wouldn't normally want to listen to. We're all from different parts of the country, which is nice because we've discussed this. And obviously we're all in the same boat with our eyes, but in different stages and different things. So it's nice to we chat, and we've always got something to say about the book. I didn't know if it would last very long, you know, because sometimes you don't, when you join these things, you don't know how good they're going to be. As I say, I thoroughly enjoyed it. And I know the other ladies have as well, because they're always saying they look forward to it each time.
What books are you reading just now then?
Well, what we've done is, because one of the ladies doesn't have the app, she does it through talking books, and there's nothing wrong with the talking books, you know, when they get delivered. But the problem with it is, because of the post, it takes so long. What we do now is we don't discuss the book every month. We set a book. The one that we have, the one we're going to talk about this time, which was really good, was Claire Douglas, Then She Vanishes. I listen to so many books. I've always got a book going. They laugh at me because I get through so many.
For more information on Talk and Support Book Clubs, the Telly Befriending Service, or anything else RNIB offer, just head to the RNIB website and search for Talk and Support. Or you can call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems. Rabbit Hole by Mark Billingham was given to us by Little Brown.
I was on my way to scrounge some tobacco from Lucy, who I sometimes called Elplay, and is probably the poshest person I've ever met, who doesn't let anyone touching her and thinks the world is flat, when I heard it all kicking off in the little room next to the canteen. The room with the yellow wallpaper and the settee. The music room, because there's some dusty bongos on a shelf and a guitar with four strings. I could still smell that watery curry Eileen had done for lunch. I'd eat it all, don't get me wrong, two plates full, because I've always had a big appetite, and you eat what's put in front of you, but the whiff of it an hour or so afterwards was making me feel slightly sick. Yeah, I remember that. Mind you, lots of things make me feel a bit green around the gills these days, and it's not like this place ever smells particularly lovely, let's be honest.
They were meant to be safe on Fleet Ward. Psychiatric patients monitored, treated and cared for, but now one of their number is found murdered, and the accusations begin to fly. Was it one of his fellow patients, a member of staff, or did someone come in from the outside? DC Alice Armitage is methodical, tireless, and she's quickly on the trail of the killer. The only problem is, Alice is a patient too.
So, I was bawling down the corridor, trying not to think about the smell and gasping for a fag, when I heard all the shouting. Swearing and screaming, stuff being chucked about, all that. This was a Wednesday afternoon, 2 days before they found the body. The sound really echoes in here, so I didn't think too much about it to begin with. It's not like I haven't seen people lose it before, so I thought it might just be a row that sounded a lot worse than it was, and it wasn't until I actually got to the doorway and saw how full-on things were that I knew I was going to have to do something about it, that I needed to step in. I'm an idiot. 3 days before they found the body. Three. It was a proper scrum in there. A couple of people were watching. One bloke I don't know very well was actually clapping, like he thought it was some kind of special entertainment that had been laid on. But everyone else was grabbing and grunting, lurching around the room and knocking furniture over. Watching from the doorway, I couldn't really tell who was doing the fighting and who was trying to stop the people who were doing the fighting. It was too late to work out what had started it, but I guessed it didn't really matter by then and probably never mattered much to begin with. It doesn't take much round here. Half a dozen of them tangled up, scratching or pulling and calling each other all sorts. A melee. That's the word, right? French, for a bunch of bad-tempered twats making idiots of themselves. Wrestling and cursing, spitting threats. The waiter, he was there, and the Somali woman who likes touching people's feet, was getting properly stuck in, which was amazing, as she's about 5 foot nothing and skinny as a stick. Ilias was throwing his considerable weight about, as was Lauren, while Donna and Big Gay Bob wriggled and squealed. And the thing was there, obviously. He was right in the thick of it, kicking a chair over, then trying to swing a punch at Kevin, who was backed up against a wall, while somebody else, whose face I couldn't see beneath the hoodie, was hanging onto the thing's arm for dear life. I mean, Christ on a bike. I wasn't remotely surprised that none of the people who get paid to sort out stuff like this were in much of a hurry. They'd seen it all before, that's the truth.
Rabbit's Hole by Mark Billingham is read by Maxine Peake and runs for 9 hours and 53 minutes.
Nominated for the 2026 International Booker Award, the director by Daniel Kelman was given to us by River Run from the Hachette Group.
Why am I in this car? I'll sit still. Sometimes, if you don't move, your memory comes back. But it's not working. One thing is certain. The driver is smoking. The vehicle is filled with heavy smoke. My eyes are burning. I feel sick. The man has grey hair, dandruff on his shoulders. On the rearview mirror, a small cross is swinging on a string of pearls. One thing at a time. The driver picked me up, held the door open for me, and the others looked on open-mouthed. Scrawny Franz Kraler, stupid Frau Einzinger, and also the small man whose name I can never remember. Because actually, at the Abendruh Sanatorium, every day is the same as the next. At breakfast, the radio is on. You go to the park. Your back hurts. There's lunch. You look at the newspaper and get annoyed while the TV is on. Some are watching. Others are sleeping. Someone is always coughing pitifully. Then it's already 3:30 and dinner is served. And then you lie awake and have to go to the bathroom every half an hour. Sometimes there are visitors, but never for me. Sometimes someone dies and is taken away. But those who are still alive are not usually picked up by a black car with a chauffeur.
G.W. Pabst was one of cinema's greatest, perhaps the greatest director of his era. When the Nazis seized power, he was filming in France, and to escape the horrors of the new Germany, he flees to Hollywood. But under the blinding California sun, the world-famous director suddenly looks like a nobody. Not even Greta Garbo, who he made famous, can help him. And thus, almost through no fault of his own, he finds himself back in his homeland of Austria. The returning family is confronted with the barbaric nature of the regime. But Goebbels, the Minister of Propaganda in Berlin, wants the film genius. He won't take no for an answer and makes big promises. While Pabst still believes that he will be able to resist these advances, that he will not submit to any dictatorship other than art, he has already taken the first steps into a hopeless entanglement. Daniel Kelman's novel about art and power, beauty and barbarism, is a triumph.
We stop at an intersection, where three teenagers with long hair are crossing the street very slowly. The driver rolls down the window and yells that another war would do young punks like them some good, and when they ignore him, he only gets angrier. He drives off, still ranting. And now it comes back to me, to the television studio. "But which program?" I ask, leaning forward. The driver turns around and looks at me through the clouds of smoke, not understanding. I repeat the question. "I don't care," he shouts. "Why should I give a damn?" So I don't say anything else. But he's getting worked up. "I want to be left alone, just left alone. Is that too much to ask?" When we stop in front of the broadcasting studio, he's just pulled himself together. He gets out, walks around the car, opens the door for me. He grabs me by the elbow, pulls me up. This is rude, but it actually helps me get on the street without falling. The facade of the broadcasting studio is even greyer than the surrounding facades. All the buildings in Vienna are grey now, except for a few that are dark brown. The whole city seems covered with dirt. In winter, the sky is stony and low. In summer, yellowishly damp. Even that was different once.
The Director, by Daniel Kelman, is narrated by Nicholas Bolton and runs for 11 hours, 31 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
RNIB's Talk and Support book clubs bring readers together by phone, offering the opportunity to enjoy a book and then talk about it with fellow readers. Carolyn Fraser is one of the volunteer facilitators who help make these conversations happen. She's told me a little about how the book club works.
I'm always dialed in first as the facilitator. So I get dialed in and then all the participants get dialed into the book group sort of one by one. So we have a few minutes where there's lots of voices as people are saying hello and we're waiting for everybody to be dialed in. But once a couple of minutes have passed, I check who's actually arrived in the meeting. And because the book group that I facilitate only started this year, we have had, I think each month we've maybe had a couple of new people join. And then maybe somebody has dropped out because they aren't able to commit to that evening. So if there are new people, we do a sort of round of introductions where we all just sort of introduce ourselves, say sort of roughly where in the country we're based and what kind of books we like reading. And then we start the sort of meeting proper and the discussion takes place. And the first part of the meeting is the discussion takes place on the book that was chosen 2 months previously. And then, say, because the book group is quite new, and it was the participants that sort of were happy to run it this way, is each month one person comes along to the book group with three suggestions. They sort of explain the books that they have chosen and then everybody votes on which one they would like to read. And we read that 2 months in advance. And that's to allow everybody time to get the book from Talking Books in whichever format they listen to it in. I try to listen to the books on Audible because quite a few of the discussions relate to the narrator and how well the book was narrated. So I always try to listen to the book as well rather than read it. It's not always possible because sometimes I can't get hold of an audio copy of the book. But most of the time I will, you know, listen to it as well so that I can join in the discussions about the narrator. And a couple of months ago, one of the participants suggested that we score the books and we score it in two categories out of five. So what people thought of the book, the actual storyline or, you know, did they enjoy it, etc. And then the second score is what did we think of the narrator? Because that's such an important part. I mean, I know that some of the participants have said that if they don't like the sound of a particular narrator's voice, they might look out for them. And if they're narrating another book that they want to read, they will sort of think again about whether, you know, but equally, if there's a narrator they really like, they'll quite often look out for books that person's narrated.
What book has scored the highest so far?
Well, we only started doing the scoring a couple of months ago, but I think it was Raising Hair, it was a non-fiction book by Chloe Dalton. And it was about, Chloe is a civil servant, but she had a property in the country and she moved out there during COVID, found a leveret in her garden and sort of took it in, but without trying to domesticate it. And that leveret then grew up to be a hare and came back and had more leverets in her garden. So it was like her story of raising that hare. And it she doesn't give it a name because she doesn't want to domesticate it. That proved very popular. But another one that, this was before we were scoring, somebody had suggested David Attenborough's Life Stories, and that was narrated by David Attenborough. And that, I think that was round about the time of his 100th birthday. And I think that was universally enjoyed, particularly because he was narrating it. And so it felt that he was actually telling the stories rather than, you know, reading them out. So that was a very popular one as well.
So has it taken you out of your reading or your listening comfort zone? Are you reading books you wouldn't have normally read?
Absolutely. I think because people are, so I think each person who's choosing the books, they're choosing exactly, you know, the sort of books that they would like to read. And personally, I don't read too much non-fiction, but Raising Hair was non-fiction, the David Attenborough one was. So it's reading books that I probably wouldn't have picked up myself. And it's been great because it's opening up different books to me that I wouldn't have read. And actually, because each participant is bringing along, you know, taking it in turns, but bringing along three books, somebody also suggested that it would be really useful to be given a note of the two books that weren't successful. And we've found that quite a lot of the participants are then adding those books to their sort of to-be-read list and are actually reading them as well. I know myself, I've written down books thinking, oh, that sounds good, I'll get round to reading that at some point. So I think it's, for all of us, giving us books that we wouldn't have come across, genres that we wouldn't necessarily have considered. So yes, it was great for sort of broadening your reading horizons.
What made you want to become a facilitator and how did you go about it?
This is actually my sort of second stab at being a facilitator. I started in 2009. I was looking for a sort of volunteering opportunity and I love reading. And so I'd gone on a volunteering website and found details of the RNIB's talk and support. They were looking for more book group facilitators. So I applied, I did the training, and that ran for about 10 years. But then I think it was 2019, they decided to sort of like relook at the book groups and how they were running. And so my group came to an end at that point. But sort of during COVID and after, I was thinking, oh, it's such a shame that that book group ended, because that probably would have been, not only is it a connection, connecting people who've got a common interest, I was really missing sort of doing that volunteer role because I'd really enjoyed it. So I got in touch with the RNIB and said, I'm not sure if your book groups are still running anymore, but if they are, I'd love to take up the volunteer role of a facilitator again. I'd said which evening I could do, and they advertised the book group, and it took a while to get enough participants to run one, but we started at the beginning of the year. So we're the first Tuesday of every month, and we've now got 7 participants, and I think one more is starting in September, so there'll be 8. So yeah, so it was really my love of reading and looking for a volunteer role, and this was, you know, absolute, you know, match made in heaven.
People have got different levels of confidence. What do you do if someone's been a bit quiet and not really keen to join in?
That can be quite tricky, but it's just, I think, trying to I make a note of everybody that's attending, and Dan that I liaise with and talk and support is great for sending me. He'll remind the participants ahead of the book group, and he will tell me who has said they're going to be attending. So I sort of like keep a list of the attendees in front of me and try to make sure that everybody gets a chance to speak. And definitely when we're discussing the book, I will, you know, tick off each person's name as they've said what they thought about the book and what they thought about the narrator. And that way I can make sure that everybody gets the chance to discuss the book. And then because we're taking it in turns, each of the participants will then have their turn to nominate books for the 2 months ahead. So again, they sort of take center stage, but everybody takes a turn at that to make sure that we're not, you know, it's not just one or two people coming up with suggestions. And I think one thing that I would say is that it's discussing the books from a general, what do you think of the book? What I wouldn't want people to think is, oh, I can't join a book group because we're going to be going into depth or doing like a sort of critical analysis of the book. It's more just exactly what people thought about it. And if they want to talk about the structure or, you know, that's great. But it's all you have to really have, I think, to be part of one of the book groups is just a love of reading and a willingness to read anything that's suggested.
Does the social side come as important as the book discussion?
I think so. I mean, nobody gives away too many details because of, you know, sort of like GDPR and the, but I think everybody is then able to express, you know, just it's a whole hour of talking to like-minded people. I mean, I would say one of the things, I'm probably the biggest reader in my family, and it's great having an opportunity to speak to people that are like-minded, love reading, love different kinds of books. And just having that 1 hour a month where you're, yeah, just talking to like-minded people. And I think the only sort of laughing complaint we all have is at the end of each session, everybody goes away with a load more books that they then want to read because we've picked up so many hints of other books. So I think it's, yeah, for everybody, it is just for, you know, for all of us, it's a really good chance to just spend time speaking to like-minded people that you know are not going to be bored talking about books.
You ever had to break up a fight?
No fights. I mean, I think quite a few people in the group like psychological thrillers. So there's a tendency to like the same genre, but we've got people who like poetry, people who like non-fiction. And I think everybody just appreciates just finding out books that they wouldn't necessarily have come across and giving them a try. But yeah, no fights yet.
So if someone's listening who's thinking about joining a book club, would you recommend it to them?
Absolutely. I would say please don't hesitate. And everybody in the group is so friendly. I mean, last month we had two new participants, and at the end they both thanked everyone for making them so welcome. And it's such a friendly group. And so we haven't been going that long, so it's not, I don't think you would have to feel like you were joining a sort of closed club where everybody have been going for years, and they're so welcoming to newcomers that I would say definitely join it. If you like reading, then I would recommend it wholeheartedly.
For more information, just search for Talk and Support RNIB. And let's stick with volunteer facilitator Carolyn for the books of her life. Was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
Yeah, definitely. It was The Phantom Tollbooth by Norton Juster. My dad had to go to America for work, and when he came back, he brought me a book, and that it was The Phantom Tollbooth. And it was the first book that I was old enough, I think, to remember reading and being completely transported to other worlds. it's sort of like a Gulliver's Travel in that he goes to different worlds in this toll booth, and there was the world of numbers and letters. And I just, yeah, absolutely loved that book. And I definitely think that was the start of me sort of enjoying reading.
There was once a boy named Milo who didn't know what to do with himself. Not just sometimes, but always. When he was in school, he longed to be out. And when he was out, he longed to be in. On the way, he thought about coming home, and coming home, he thought about going. Wherever he was, he wished he were somewhere else. And when he got there, he wondered why he'd bothered. Nothing really interested him, least of all the things that should have. "It seems to me that almost everything is a waste of time," he remarked one day as he walked dejectedly home from school. "I can't see the point in learning to solve useless problems or subtracting turnips from turnips or knowing where Ethiopia is or how to spell February." And since no one bothered to explain otherwise, he regarded the process of seeking knowledge as the greatest waste of time of all. As he and his unhappy thoughts hurried along, for while he was never anxious to be where he was going, he liked to get there as quickly as possible. It seemed a great wonder that the world, which was so large, could sometimes feel so small and empty. "And worst of all," he continued sadly, "there's nothing for me to do, nowhere I'd care to go, and hardly anything worth seeing." He punctuated this last thought with such a deep sigh that a house sparrow singing nearby stopped and rushed home to be with his family. Without stopping or looking up, Milo dashed past the buildings and busy shops that lined the street, and in a few minutes reached home, dashed through the lobby, hopped onto the elevator, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and off again, opened the apartment door, rushed into his room, flopped dejectedly into a chair, and grumbled softly, "Another long afternoon."
The Phantom Tollbooth by Norton Juster is narrated by Rain Wilson. It's available commercially, but you may have to hunt for it as it's not officially for sale in the UK. Is there a book on a rainy day you could happily reread?
Yeah, it's funny. I don't often reread books, but my favourite book is The Crow Road by Ian Banks. And I think it's also got one of the most iconic first lines of a book that I've ever read, because it starts by saying it was the day that my grandmother exploded. And that's all I would say about that, because if anyone wants to read it, it all becomes apparent why that happens. He's one of my favourite authors, unfortunately no longer with us. So I have reread quite a few of his books, but I must have reread The Crow Road 5 or 6 times, including just a few months ago. I think it was over winter time. I thought, oh, what do I fancy reading next? I'm going to reread The Crow Road.
It was the day my grandmother exploded. I sat in the crematorium, listening to my Uncle Hamish quietly snoring in harmony to Bach's Mass in B minor, and I reflected that it always seemed to be death that drew me back to Gallanoch. I looked at my father sitting 2 rows away in the front line of seats in the cold echoing chapel. His broad, greying brown head was massive above his tweed jacket. A black armband was his concession to the solemnity of the occasion. His ears were moving in a slow oscillatory manner, rather in the way John Wayne's shoulders moved when he walked. My father was grinding his teeth. Probably he was annoyed that my grandmother had chosen religious music for her funeral ceremony. I don't think she'd done it to upset him. Doubtless she'd simply liked the tune and had not anticipated the effect its non-secular nature might have on her eldest son. My younger brother James sat to my father's left. It was the first time in years I'd seen him without his Walkman, and he looked distinctly uncomfortable, fiddling with his single earring. To my father's right, my mother sat, upright and trim, neatly filling a black coat and sporting a dramatic black hat shaped like a flying saucer. The UFO dipped briefly to one side as she whispered something to my father. In that movement and that moment, I felt a pang of loss that did not entirely belong to my recently departed grandmother, yet was connected with her memory. How her moles would be itching today if she was somehow suddenly reborn. Prentice! My Aunt Antonia, sitting next to me with Uncle Hamish snoring mellifluously on her other side, tapped my sleeve and pointed at my feet as she murmured my name. I looked down. I had dressed in black that morning, in the cold high room of my aunt and uncle's house. The floorboards had creaked and my breath had smoked. There had been ice inside the small dormer window, obscuring the view over Galanach in a crystalline mist. I'd pulled on a pair of black underpants I'd brought especially from Glasgow, a white shirt fresh from Marks and Sparks, the pack line still ridging the cold, crisp cotton, and my black 501s. I'd shivered and sat on the bed, looking at two pairs of socks, one black, one white. I'd intended to wear the black pair under my 9-eye docks with the twin ankle buckles, but suddenly I had felt that the boots were wrong. Maybe it was because they were matte finish. The last funeral I'd been to, also the first funeral I'd ever been to, this gear had all seemed pretty appropriate. But now I was pondering the propriety of the docks, the 501s and the black biker's jacket. I'd hauled my white trainers out of the bag, tried one Nike on and one boot unlaced. I stood in front of the tilted full-length mirror, shivering, my breath going out in clouds, while the floorboards creaked and a smell of cooking bacon and burnt toast insinuated its way up from the kitchen. The trainers, I decided.
The Crow Road by Ian Banks is available from R&IB Talking Books as read by Joel Dunlop. Is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be contemporary, but something you've read recently that's fresh in the mind you'd like to recommend.
One that I really liked and was Mayflies by Andrew O'Hagan. And I listened to him on the programme where Harriet Gilbert has two guests and they each choose a book and Harriet does and they discuss it. And I think on there he was talking about Mayflies is actually based on his real life. And I think it's been made into a television programme as well. Not that I've seen the TV programme, but that was, I really enjoyed that. And I've recommended it to quite a few friends who've also really enjoyed it. Because sometimes I'm wary of recommending books and people sort of like, well, that's not really my thing. But yeah, no, Mayflies is one that I read and really enjoyed.
Tully Dawson made himself new to the world and ripe for the glories of that summer by showing he was unlike his father. It wasn't a matter to fight over. Some families are made up of strangers and nothing can change it. But I think it always bothered Tully that Woodbine couldn't cheer him on when he came by the football field to watch the game. The old man would only shake his head in a know-all way and stare at the Firth of Clyde with an injured look. Tully had named him after the cigarettes. They all had their nicknames, those reluctant fathers. They sat at home opening cans of lager and cursing our Saturday nights. I suppose we could have drifted over to the touchline and asked his opinion, but being young is a kind of warfare in which the great enemy is experience. Our cheeks burned and we watched him walk towards the unstained light of the harbour. 1984 was the end of Old Woodbine, or 1985, when the strike ended and the Ayrshire men returned one by one to the pits, met at the gates by women giving out carnations. The miners had fought hard, but they were all sacked within a month.
"He takes his shame out on us," Tully said. "I suppose Thatcher never really got it about the enemy within."
And that comment was pure Tully. You can imagine how his whole spirit, as well as his famous good looks and his green eyes, came from a dream of the freedom that existed just beyond his dad. But the photographs tell a sadder story, the saddest one, because Woodbine had green eyes too. Irvine Newtown, east of eternity. Tully was 20 years old and a lathe turner. He impersonated Arthur Seaton from Saturday Night and Sunday Morning by taunting his boss all week and drinking pints of black and tan all weekend. He looked like Albert Finney, all slicked up hair, but in Tully's case, spiked with soap. At that time, he had the kind of looks that appeal to all sexes and all ages, and his natural effrontery opened people up. He was in a band, obviously. They had sprung into existence the previous winter. They were called The Bicycle Factory, another Saturday Night reference, and would later flirt with success and change their name several times as Tully went from singer to drummer. When people asked why he was so often the best man at weddings, it was clear they hadn't known Tully Dawson in his prime. He had innate charisma, a brilliant record collection, complete fearlessness in political argument, and he knew how to love you more than anybody else. Other guys were funny and brilliant and better at this and that, but Tully loved you. He had the leader thing when he was young, the guts of the classic frontman. And if any of us got together, we instantly wanted to know where he was. Some people gain that status with power or with money, but Tully did it with pure cheek. His brighter language made older people seem dull. His dad wanted to constrain the future with robotic disappointment, drinking all day at the Twa Dugs. And Tully was ready for flight. He wasn't so much the butterfly as the air on which it travels. And that summer, he was ready for an adventure beyond the Ayrshire hedges.
Mayflies by Andrew O'Hagan is in the RNIB Talking Books Library as read by the author. That's it for today's show. We'll be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.